Welcome to Coastal Conversations, a monthly program that deals with major issues confronting the nation's coastal areas, marine and Great Lakes. This program is made possible through the generosity of the Roddenberry Foundation. I'm Jerry Schubel with the Aquarium of the Pacific, and I'm your host. Today we're going to explore the topic of adapting to the new normal along our coasts. We'll focus on our marine coasts and not the Great Lakes. First, we will establish some of the distinguishing qualities of that new normal, and then we will explore with two experienced social scientists and policy analysts what our options are for adapting to, for coping with this new normal. Joining me today are Dr. Michael Orbach, Professor of Marine Affairs and Policy at Duke University, Director of the Coastal Environmental Management Program in the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke, and former director of the Duke Marine Lab. Margaret Davidson is returning for her third appearance on Coastal Conversations. She is the director of the NOAA Office of Ocean and Coastal Resource Management. Before joining NOAA, Margaret was executive director of the South Carolina Sea Grant Consortium. I'm in Long Beach, California, and Margaret and Mike are in Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome. Thank you for joining me today. Let me start by trying very briefly to describe some of the distinguishing qualities of the new normal so we can get into how to adapt to them, to cope with them. The most obvious element of the new normal is the higher stand of sea level. Let's look at the first slide. Sea level has been rising since the end of the last ice age, some 18,000 years ago, with the retreat of the glaciers and meltwater. What was added to the ocean, causing sea level to rise by nearly 400 feet. Sea level rose rapidly until about 8,000 years ago, when it flattened out and has remained fairly constant until recently. It was during that time that civilization developed, and many of the world's large cities were built along the coast. In the next slide, you can see that about 100 to 135 years ago, sea level began to rise more rapidly. And in the next slide, the question is, what will it do in the future? We know it will continue to rise. The only question is, by how much? The prevailing opinion is that by the end of this century, sea level will be about 3 feet higher than today, but it could be significantly higher, depending upon a number of factors, primarily what happens to the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. So the possible range is quite large, but it will continue to rise. The next image you see is of New Orleans following Katrina in the fall of 2005. And in the next slide, this is New York City following Superstorm Sandy in October of 2012. These two events, Katrina and Sandy, show what major storms can do. Whether or not storms like this increase in frequency and or intensity in the future as a result of climate change, tropical storms will be superimposed on a higher sea, making them more destructive. And we should emphasize that sea level will not be like a storm. It will be essentially a permanent change of state. So what's the new normal we will have to live with for as long as we can see into the future? Sea level will not stop at 3 feet. It will continue over the next several hundred years to even greater heights. It's also important to note that there are things that humans can do to mitigate, that is, to avoid certain causes and effects of climate change. However, because of the long time lags, and the time scale of Earth's systems, no matter how we try to mitigate in the short run, sea level will continue to rise. Our two experts will tell us what we need to do to adapt, to cope with this new normal. First, would either of you like to add to my dimensions of the new normal, add what I might have missed? Mike, Margaret?
Well, Mike, what's that? I'd like to emphasize three of your points. First one is that it's new for humans. We've never faced this in our period of built infrastructure. It is, in fact, certain. The only question is the rate. and it is not like a storm. It's permanent. People who you speak to on the street about this tend to have a difficult time with those three points.
Margaret, would you like to add anything to that?
If I may add a point, yes. In addition to the importance of time lags and geological time scales, I think it's important for people to realize that the process by which we produce reports, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the National Climate Assessment, as well as the method by which we produce new model outputs, suggests that even low scenarios are themselves fairly conservative, and that information is actually dated by at least a decade. So when one is looking at a range of scenarios, recognize that that's really information that's at least a decade old, and everything that we've seen in the last decade suggests that we are really trending more towards the high end of the scenarios and less towards the low end of sea level rise scenarios.
Okay, so that's then the new normal that we're referring to today. And we're going to focus on adapting to it, that is, coping with it. We're also going to focus on the marine coasts, and we're not talking about the Great Lakes. Their problems are different. Lake levels tend to be falling. Over the longer term, we do need to mitigate the drivers of sea level rise by reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases. But that's a long-term effort, and there's enough inertia in the system that sea level will continue to rise long after we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. What will be the major societal impacts from rising sea levels? Mike, I want to start with you, and then I'll turn to Margaret.
Sure. The initial effects will be, in a sense, subtle, but there'll be things like the gravity-fed water infrastructure, sewers, for example, will stop working very well. So sewers backing up, street drains, storm drains backing up will be some of the first major and pervasive effects. Now, as the effects get more commonly seen around the world, you're going to see other phenomena, such as the resources to address this, whether it's defense or retreat or something else, will quite quickly start to gravitate to the big cities and away from the smaller towns and rural areas, who will probably be left a bit in the lurch and on their own in dealing with these things. The other thing that will come into play is that because it's not just the ocean face itself that's the issue, but low-lying areas, many of which are in estuaries and in river basins, which tend to have more people of lower socioeconomic statuses living in them, might be some of the less desirable places to have built in the future. There may be an uneven effect on people at different socioeconomic levels as the sea level starts to rise as well, because it'll affect first the low-lying areas.
Margaret, what would you add to the list of major societal impacts of a rising sea and also of storms superimposed upon a higher sea?
So I agree with Michael that one of the most immediate first effects is around infrastructure. He mentioned gravity-fed sewers and septic systems, I would add. But we've already seen in many geographies where roads that run very close to the coast are more frequently overtopped by storms and elevated tide levels, not just storm levels. So this whole issue of vital infrastructure, roads, transportation corridors, the ports through which we bring most of America's consumer goods, these are efforts of infrastructure that are already being affected. We can see this, and in many cases, people are actually beginning to think differently about where we site this infrastructure or how we elevate it and harden it. I also think that we will begin to see changes in an economic sense. Certainly, some property values will get softer sooner than others. And I think because coastal tourism is such a big component of American GDP, this will actually begin to impact the third largest element of GDP, coastal tourism. So we're going to see shifts in patterns and locations of coastal tourism, which may in turn have a downward effect on that important component of our economic happiness.
I'd like one of you or both of you to comment on what about our electrical grid? Certainly experiences in Sandy and Katrina and this winter with storms suggest that we're pretty vulnerable.
Well, I believe that this is actually one of the bright sides, at least from a federal perspective, Jerry. The federal Department of Energy and many of the country's larger energy providers have not only been thinking about the ways in which they reduce emissions, but they've been thinking a lot harder about how they can also address issues. It's not just sea level rise for them, of course. There are other more frequent, more severe storms is already a fact. There are other issues. Extreme flooding and extreme drought also put stress on our electrical grid. And then, as you suggest, the recent events have showed us the folly of old-fashioned above-ground systems and being such a highly interconnected system. So there are a lot of discussions underway about how do we have more regional control, because we've seen both in the South and in the Northeast where power problems in one region actually have impacts, cascading impacts over a much larger geography.
Thank you. I want to turn now to a different dimension of preparation. Are we prepared in the sense of our historic and current legal principles to deal with sea level rise? Mike?
Well, actually, Margaret is the trained attorney, but I will start on this one. And the answer is no. Our law today, based on the old Roman civil law through the English common law, basically is all built, it was developed in that same period of that flat part of the curve that you showed earlier, when sea level has been constant. And consciously or not, built into that is the presumption that sea level is essentially going to stay constant. Now, as sea level rises, we're going to have to reinvent a lot of our public trust law. For example, what happens now in most riparian coastal areas, water adjacent areas, is that the private owner can own up to what is commonly called the mean high tide or mean low tide line. Now, as that line changes, there is not a lot in our regularized law that says what happens. Interestingly enough, Texas has one of the more progressive laws on this called the Open Beaches Act that carries the presumption that the property turns from private to public when it's permanently inundated. But that's relatively rare in our state and federal legal systems now. So we are going to have to reinvent a lot of our basic public trust law.
And would our attorney like to add to that?
And in a time at which we would wish that common law were more evolutionary than it is, the likelihood of also passing legislation at a federal level is certainly limited, and many states themselves are demonstrating their own form of federal imitation, and we've seen a lack of interest in being fairly progressive or even ahead of the curve on these issues. I think we're actually behind the curve, Jerry, on these issues, because this science issue has been successfully and earthly transformed into a political issue, perceived as something of limited interest to only a few, when in fact it's a societal problem. It's a societal economic, it's a societal public health and well-being problem, it's a public safety issue. But it's hard, and it requires difficult choices to be understood and made. So I believe that we won't see much legislative change in the short run, that we're going to have to look to other techniques, looking at ways to work with accountants to do things like amortize the underlying land. We are all familiar with amortizing physical built assets. The presumption being the underlying land would always be there. In some cases, that's very clearly not the case over the next 30 to 50 years. Maybe some new approaches to how bond ratings are issued to units of government at all levels. And we've already seen within the financial sectors, bank risk managers, and within the insurance, particularly the reinsurance, but increasingly the primary insurance market, an interest in identifying ways to encourage people to behave more appropriately with reducing their personal as well as societal risk.
So Margaret, the new normal, it's inevitable, and it's going to be with us for centuries. We aren't very well prepared. Are there any encouraging signs, actions that are taking place around the country? Margaret, we'll start with you.
Absolutely. And not surprisingly, most of the innovative stuff is happening at the local level, which is appropriate because that's the level at which planning and zoning actually takes place in this country. So in every part of the country, there are great examples. As you know, Deer Island Wastewater in Boston Harbor has actually been built to a higher level standard than it had been before, and that's a fairly old adaptive strategy. There are a number of communities on the East Coast, in the Mid-Atlantic and in South Florida, as well as in South Louisiana, that have begun to significantly elevate critical roadways. There is a town in New Jersey that intends to elevate its bridge, not just to the new advisory base flood elevation, but they're going to add another foot in for sea level rise. And we've even seen some communities begin to identify the need to relocate. How they relocate, where they find the funds to relocate is still an important issue. And then, of course, in your neighborhood, Jerry, out in San Diego, there's actually been some new requirements that new infrastructure also consider heightened sea level issues and other issues that are clearly related to climate change. So I think there are at least 1,000 points of bright light largely operating at the local government level right now in this country.
So Mike, you're going to move from North Carolina to higher ground in California in a few months. Is that any indication of your level of pessimism?
No, it actually isn't. That's for entirely different reasons, although the effect is as you mentioned. But I would pick up on something Margaret said. We in the United States are a bit of an outlier on response to this right now. Most of the rest of the world absolutely gets this, understands it, and even the most defended coastal country in the world, the Netherlands, in their new 10-year report is called Living with Water. They understand that as good as they are at defending from the historic water levels in the North Sea, they are not going to be able to do it into the future, and they have essentially a plan to retreat from a lot of their currently developed area over time. So the rest of the world is very much on board with this, and what Margaret said is that a lot of the heavy lifting is at the state and local level, and that's true. That's where most of the decisions that are going to matter in the end are going to be made, is at the state and local level. You know, we have an odd situation here, if no other place in our U.S. House of Representatives, this odd paralysis on anything having to do with climate change. It's truly very weird and aberrant. Hopefully it will go away at some point because there's no real scientific basis for it. But it's truly an odd situation of paralysis at the federal level on this issue right now.
But so you say the Netherlands is going to give up something like 25% of its land area, but it will still protect 75%. And when we look at this country, there's strategic retreat. But if we look at places like New York City and Boston, other major coastal cities, doesn't it make sense that they're going to stand and fight and that we will retreat from less populated areas? Margaret?
Absolutely. We will, and even the Dutch, I mean, they have a weir to protect the Rotterdam port from the 10,000-year storm. But they also are designing with nature, using natural defenses, and as Michael mentioned, they're looking to relocate people from low-lying areas. But recall that they have a 1,000-year cultural history of government involvement in flooding issues, which is very different than our cultural history. So I think we will stand and defend where we have a lot of money already sunk. That's why I think the best options in the very short run are to be much more thoughtful, strategic about both the where and the how we pour concrete, because whatever our concrete footprint is, it either locks in our risk or it exacerbates our risk for decades, if not centuries, to come. But we have to realize that in our country, why we have located small communities, we really haven't undertaken any major voluntary resettlement of populations.
So, Mike, would you like to add to anything that Margaret has said about whether where we will defend and where we will probably retreat strategically?
Well, I think she's generally right, that we will try to defend the more highly capitalized, denser areas. Now, the interesting part of this is what happens when the sea level rise gets to 2, 3, and 4 meters, where you will not, one of the first cities that will have a problem will be Miami, because it is based on a rather porous a substrate. So even if they build very big walls on the edges, the water is going to come up from the sides and from underneath. That's the other thing. Water tables are going to rise, not just the sea. And so when it comes to not being able to have Miami as a viable city, what do you do with Miami? In two senses. Do you move it to Georgia? Do you move it to Kentucky? Do you not try to move it at all, but reinvent it as a set of smaller, more mobile locations? And the other problem, which I actually predict is going to be one of the bigger problems, is what do we do with the stuff we leave behind? So when, in fact, Miami and Lower Manhattan are abandoned and inundated, do we take them apart and recycle or salvage them? Do we leave them there as new recreational diving attractions for scuba divers? What do we do with these places that are going to be abandoned?
And I think it we probably shouldn't get into that right now, but it seems to me Miami faces more immediate threats than New York City. And as you mentioned, particularly the intrusion of salt water into their groundwater and the need to find other sources of fresh water. All of these programs are very expensive. Given the present fiscal climate, how do we begin to make the necessary investments? Who'd like to start?
Margaret will suggest that we really have to, not just for sea level rise reasons, but just simply to remain competitive in a global economy, we have to not only reinvent our infrastructure to be both more resilient and more adaptive, things on piers perhaps that can float, but we have to invent new ways of paying for it, public-private ventures, new ways of bonding. I know when I was growing up in the great state of Texas, a lot of our early raceways that we called highways, we actually funded through tolls, which were another means of generating revenue without requiring taxation authority directly. I think that cities like Chicago and some other older cities have also already been experimenting with how do they attract more private money into new infrastructure investments. So we're going to have to be creative even without climate change. And I think it adds an extra impetus to be both more imaginative in how we think of infrastructure and how we structure ourselves with our infrastructure, but also who do we bring to the party with us? Because continuity of business actually depends on being able to move goods and services. So transportation is not just a public interest, it's an economic interest.
Mike, would you like to add to that?
Sure. I think there's no question about whether we'll be able to afford it, because the whole history of human society is people spend what they need on what they really want to do. If you'd asked the American public before World War II if we could afford World War II, they would have said no, but we did because it had to be done. This will be some of the same situation. Now, the other part of this is there is an opportunity to reinvent our coastal and low-lying areas as more sustainable, infrastructure and investment. We can reinvent the new things we build in a generation or two more green than they have been, for example. So I think there are lots of opportunities here. The question is going to be, what's the startup phase look like? And that's a problem because right now, the serious effects, by which I mean over a foot or two, are 30 or 40 years off. That's beyond current political cycles. It's very difficult to get the first move to occur on the chessboard here.
And it's interesting because, as you say, this problem, to a large extent, is going to sneak up on us, except when it gets punctuated by a major event like Sandy or Katrina. Mm-hmm. So we're clearly going to need more diverse portfolios of funding sources. But for a minute, let's turn to some other constraints. Do we have the necessary data and information to make good decisions? Margaret, do we?
We have sufficient and appropriate physical information. I think what we lack is the psychological information as well as the testosterone.
So we need more social scientists and some very bold, courageous people.
Well, I think we always need bold, courageous people, particularly at pivotal moments throughout society. We've always depended on people leading us into the future. I think that for many Americans, we have to translate the range of physical, social, and economic impacts into a language that they understand. It's unfortunate that most Americans seem to think that we should think about government as though it was our household checkbook, although that's been a prevailing metaphor. I like to think about this issue as, you mentioned portfolio a moment ago, stock portfolio. So if there were actually good investment strategies that were going to get you a better return on investment, versus staying with the portfolio that you have that's actually losing percentage points every year, I don't think there's a rational person in the United States that wouldn't say, let's go with that medium risk, higher return portfolio. And yet when we lay this out here as, you know, infrastructure, new jobs, creative jobs, ways to retain our standing, we still have difficulty even pitching it on the basis of one of the fundamental foundations of economic progress. So I think we have to figure out some new ways to communicate things that are very supported by data and facts and trends, and we have to figure out how we depoliticize them.
Well, I think that depoliticization is an important phrase. Tom Friedman's op-ed piece in the New York Times recently talked about we need bold ideas, and he was in Silicon Valley and he said bold ideas are born here and they go to Washington to die. It seems to me we should raise our expectations of the role that the federal government has to play. So sea level rise is a gradual process, a few millimeters a year, and although the rate may decrease, how do we deal with the long time frames, decades and centuries, because they're beyond the current political cycles? And we've already looked at this a little bit, but Mike, what are your thoughts? How do we deal with these time frames?
Well, to start with the data question that you asked, Margaret, the big piece of data that we don't have with great accuracy or precision is the rate of sea level rise. But we know the direction, and we have a good sense of what the approximate magnitudes are going to be. Now, the other thing that we have, and this goes to your second question about how we start to prepare for this, is we have excellent telemetry data on current heights of land above sea level. We have excellent GIS systems for formatting georeference data. When communities ask me what's the first thing we need to be doing, I said, get yourself a good GIS analysis of the topography of your place so that you know when this happens at 1 feet, 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 feet. You can think about what's going to be affected, which of your infrastructure is going to be infected first, which roads, which sewers, which septic systems, which emergency evacuation routes, which houses. That technology is absolutely available and can be applied by anyone, even with modest means in small communities now. So the first thing to do is to take advantage of that technology that is absolutely in hand to begin thinking about the problem. That's the first step.
And I think also, though, as you point out, we need these long-term data sets, and that takes a consistency of commitment primarily by the federal government. And in conjunction with those, we need to continue to refine our predictive capabilities through models. And on top of this, though, we should never waste a good disaster. Did we waste Katrina and Sandy, or let me put it in more politically correct terms? Did we take full advantage of these disasters in adapting to the new normal? Who'd like to respond to that?
So since I grew up on the Gulf Coast, let me say we totally wasted the opportunity that Katrina recognized to reframe the conversation, not just in Louisiana and Mississippi, but in the country as a whole. I think that conversation kind of focused on how could we be so dumb as to live there? And since that's the place where I got my web feet, I resembled that comment. In contrast, as I like to joke, I think Sandy, maybe because it hit an area of the country with a higher level of educational attainment, maybe some Ivy League schools, or maybe it's just that it's economically more obviously important, I think that opportunity presented itself, and I see some fascinating things happening in the post-Sandy world that I didn't actually think possible a decade ago after Katrina. Certainly in New York City, former Mayor Bloomberg does prove that axiom that which governs best is a benevolent dictator. They were actually already somewhat prepared for an event like Sandy because they had been actually thinking and planning for this for almost the previous decade. That's why they had some balloons available for some of the subways, though not all. And certainly both at the federal level, in terms of criteria associated with monies being spent for rebuilding, or the study that the Army Corps of Engineers is doing, we've been able to actually get some fact-based criteria into the rebuilding phase. And that is fairly unique.
Part of the challenge, though, is to keep that conversation going, to keep the ideas in play. And Mike, do you want to add to anything to that?
Yeah, I think there are some interesting common lessons that came out of Katrina and Sandy. One of them was that in both cases, there were attempts by both local governments and the federal and state governments to buy out property that was low-lying, that it had repetitive losses over time. In both cases, those attempts did not work out very well. That is, most of the properties that were where that conversation was brought up did not, in fact, get bought out. Maybe a few more in Sandy than in Katrina. We'll see. But in general, the places where a lot of people said, we really shouldn't be rebuilding here, are, in fact, being rebuilt. So the good news is that people attempted to bring that question up. The bad news is it didn't go very far. But I want to take a little bit of issue with something you said a minute ago, Jerry, about politics. In the end, all responses to this question will be political, in the sense that politics is the art of making trade-offs among different flows of costs and benefits, different value systems, different belief systems. And so we should be prepared for this to be an intensely political process. What we need to require is that it's a transparent political process. So I know in North Carolina, for example, we have a group called NC20 that's famous for being climate science deniers and led to some of the things that Stephen Colbert pointed out in his famous TV spot. And when I talk to those people, they actually don't deny the climate science. The main factor I find is fear. They know the effects this is all going to have, and they know that we don't really have a way to deal with it now that anybody has at the front of their mind. We need, and so their response is, let's not talk about it. Now, that is absolutely the wrong response. Political systems don't work well in conditions of secrecy to the public, who has to make the political decision in the end. We need to have all the information on the table, and we need to get to the process making these decisions. So in the end, it will be a political process. We just have to have it be a fully found political process.
Yeah, very good point. And I think you had a phrase in there that's very important. We need to be willing to make trade-offs, and that's part of the political process, and to compromise. Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't said anything about natural communities, that salt marshes and other communities, how they cope with the rising sea. Who would like to add just a short comment about that? Because these are very important to, as part of the world's, the planet's living infrastructure. Who wants to add something about our natural coastal systems?
Well, I'll start. When I advise people about the first thing they need to do besides get a good map, it's decide on the basis of that map where you're going to move your human infrastructure and populations and where you're going to move your natural infrastructure. We can tell in most cases where a marsh or a mangrove swamp is going to tend to move as sea level rise. And marshes and mangrove swamp have moved up and down infinite numbers of times in history as sea level has gone up and down. Problem is, we're in the way with our infrastructure now. So we do need absolutely to start planning for that. It's interesting because when you talk to places, to groups like Nature Conservancy, they tend to be still spending a lot of money, for example, protecting marshes that are clearly going to be underwater 50 years from now. And I keep saying to them, you need to be buying the upland next to that marsh now. Now, they haven't moved to that, and I'm not criticizing Nature Conservancy. They do a great job. But that mentality has not shifted yet, and that's what we need to be doing, is starting to say, let's protect the land where the natural infrastructure is going to tend to move.
So, Margaret, go ahead.
Yes, I think that's actually another place where we can learn from the Dutch. So besides make room for the river, they also talk about designing with nature. Mm-hmm. So in addition to the fabulous acts of civil engineering that they're so well known for, they themselves have been recreating things like offshore oyster reefs and creating ridges and swells in the landscape, recreating wetlands and maritime forests, because they understand that these defenses, these natural defenses that Mother Nature can provide or be encouraged to provide, actually are extraordinarily cost effective, much more effective than many of our acts of concrete wonder. And one of the more positive trends that I've seen in the post-Sandy is, in fact, in places like the back of Staten Island, portions of Long Island Sound, small, wonky people call them green infrastructure. Scientists tend to call it ecosystem services, flood protection, food provision, water filtration. But normal people call it natural defenses. We have some very concrete examples of where natural defenses really help provide that protection. We're trying to quantify that in economic terms now. And we're seeing, at least in the New York City area, where those kinds of projects are being expanded. We need to think about this from a systems approach. How do we design the gray and the green together to maximize the effect while reducing the costs to the net benefit of society?
So to continue to receive the benefits, the ecosystem benefits of salt marshes and on some other coastal ecosystems, we're going to have to give them pathways or corridors to move landward as sea level rises or to build vertically. Let's come back just for a minute about to the vulnerability of different people and how we can help them cope. Because the poor, the older people, the less affluent like me are going to be more vulnerable than Margaret, than a young woman well off like you. How can we level the playing field?
Well, I certainly think that the elderly, the poor, the ill, and other sorts of vulnerable populations, have been shown to be incredibly exposed and not well thought of, both in Katrina and Sandy. And I believe we learned some lessons after Katrina. It wasn't quite so patently awful after Sandy, except for those individuals who were so adversely affected. This is one of the problems, Jerry. There's a huge disconnect because these kinds of costs are actually disproportionately borne at the local level. Costs at mental health centers, costs at local public health centers, domestic abuse centers. These aren't things that we insure at the federal level or insure through private funds. These aren't even things that the state house tends to reimburse. And yet these are very high and long-term continuing costs that occur after significant events that fall disproportionately on local populations. You know, I think if we can be uniquely the only country in the world that bails out people for living in areas that have repetitive flooding, then we need a corollary to that that helps the people who have limited means. Or maybe we should just have means-tested aid, both in the recovery sense as well as in other senses. Maybe flood insurance. Since we postponed the difficult decisions with flood insurance, maybe it should only really be available to those who can't afford to self-insure, for instance. I think we need to think a little smarter about the usual problem set. But first of all, I think we have a moral and social obligation, not to mention an economic issue, of taking care of the least, because they are not only a moral challenge, they are a financial drag on our economy, and we need to address that up front.
All right. An informed public is obviously very important in a lot of the things that we've talked about. What role does public education play in all of this, and do you, either of you have any suggestions for making our messages more relevant? Margaret, I'm going to start with you and then ask Mike to add to it.
Well, so of course, Jerry, I love to see things like aquariums and other discovery centers head-on address issues related to extreme events and climate. You can talk about it through the obvious environmental impacts on fisheries or through ocean and other ocean and coastal resources. But the allegedly sentient critters are part of the ecosystem as well. So I think that that message is that if we really want to follow self-interest, then we need to understand that it's the system that protects us, and we need to think about ourselves in the system. And I think that's a great message for organizations like yours to help carry in a much more effective way than government agencies or universities seem to be able to do these days.
And this is something that Coastal America's Coastal Ecosystem Learning Center Network really is trying to focus on, because we have 25 aquariums that get to more than 25 million people a year, and we're trying to energize that network to deal with some of these issues. Mike, what would you add to that?
I think we need to avoid preaching to the choir on this topic. We do a lot of talking in journals and even in our beautiful aquarium systems and interpretive center systems in this country, but we need to take this discussion to the Rotary Clubs and to the Lions Clubs and to the League of Women Voters meetings and to Chambers of Commerce luncheons. We need to get these this information out to people where they live in communities who maybe don't think about coastal ocean issues on a day-to-day basis. That, I think, is a very high return investment on our money to go to these audiences that don't normally hear these kinds of things and get this kind of information in a format that they can easily absorb it. So I think we need to talk not just to the people who agree with us, but the people who don't.
Good point. We're nearing the end of our time. Would either of you like to make a closing statement, a brief closing statement? Margaret, we'll start with you.
So I'll follow on Mike's comments. I think each one of us needs to assume the responsibility to teach at least another who's coming from a different perspective about these issues. I echo that we need to take the conversation into venues where it's not being heard or held. And the final aphorism, today's flood is tomorrow's high tide.
Thank you, Mike.
I would like to say that we absolutely have the resources and will eventually have the political will to deal with this issue. We are fortunately not in the case of a country such as Bangladesh that has literally millions of desperately poor people who will literally have nowhere to go when most of their country is underwater. We are, as a country, in a very fortunate position of having the resources, of having the data and information, and generally the public policy structures that will enable us to deal with this. So I think there's a lot, even though the changes will be drastic, they will be life-changing, they will certainly reinvent our coastal societies as we know it today, it's absolutely something that we can deal with.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank both Michael Orbach and Margaret Davidson for joining me for this edition of Coastal Conversations. I also want to thank the Roddenberry Foundation for making Coastal Conversations possible. We hope you will join us for the next Coastal Conversation on March 27th. The topic will be Why Aren't They Listening?, in which we're going to explore how we can be more effective in getting our senior elected and appointed officials in Washington to pay attention to ocean issues and also the general public. I'm Jerry Schubel for Coastal Conversations. Thank you. Thank you.